This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 42 of What's It Like. My guest is Mick Keebler, or Keebler, the great French general of the French Revolutionary War, born in 1753. Or not?
Well, actually, the way my name is pronounced is Kleber. It's the Americanization of his name, which was Kleber.
Aha, Kleber.
Yes.
Or there's a German version, too,
isn't there? Yes, there is. Well, actually, the name comes from the Alsace, which is that area, that region right between Germany and France. And at one time or another during history, it was either ruled by the French or ruled by the Germans. So as one would sweep in and the other would sweep out, the name would change from Kleber to Kleber, which is the German version. And then in Switzerland, there's a famous tire company, Kleber, as well.
Mm-hmm. So are you related to any of those people?
Yeah. My grandfather was later in his life became an avid amateur genealogist, and Jean-Baptiste Kleber, the general under Napoleon, is a direct descendant. We're directly descended from him. And although he never had any children, but he's part of an extended family, and we come from there. I find it kind of interesting that when you do a sort of a Google search for our name, it's not that common in the United States, but. A while back, one of my relatives had a study done, a worldwide sort of study done on the name, and a lot of the people with our last name seemed to congregate into just a couple of different types of professions. There's a lot that are involved in medicine or some side of that, and then there are a good bunch that are involved in music.
Really?
And these are both things that have sort of come up in my family as well. So it's very kind of interesting. I don't know how that actually happens, but it's quite intriguing to speculate as to why that sort of thing might go down.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
Well, my dad was a career Marine officer, so I lived in various parts of the country growing up, mostly on the West Coast in the Southern California area when I was younger, and also in Hawaii, and then later mostly on the East Coast around the Washington, D.C. area, and for a few years down in Fort Benning, Georgia. So throughout our family life, there was a lot of moving around back and forth across the country, mostly civil service schools, which was a good thing, in that when you go back into history into the 50s and whatever, especially if you're moving in and around the South, there was segregation and a lot of patch equality when it came to schools. So we were always being educated by federal workers, and we had great athletic facilities because of the military bases that we grew up on, and it was really quite a good childhood.
How did moving around influence you?
Well, I think on the one hand, it makes for a tighter family, and it can kind of stunt you socially in the sense that you're a young kid and you're growing up and trying to sort of navigate the normal issues, boys and girls, and your sort of status within your peer group and that sort of thing. And then your peer group, the whole cast of your peer group changes every year or two, So you're not going to be the one that gets elected to the president of your class because mm-hmm. nobody knows who you are. But for me, one of the things that helped was that I got involved in athletics. So immediately whenever I would be, move from one school to another, I would join, a variety of teams. And that way I would sort of build a network of, acquaintances. And then as time went on, I was fortunate enough to spend, I never really spent more than 2 years in any one place, except for down there in Fort Benning. And that was, a couple of different schools anyway, because that's where I transitioned from, like, junior high into high school and that kind of thing. So it was kind of difficult to say goodbye to your friends, over and over and over again and start from scratch. But it kind of gives you a sense of who you are and what you stand for and what's important for you, regardless of what the environment is. So I think it really served me well. I think if you ask my brother, who's younger than I am, he would probably answer that it was more difficult for him because he just didn't really, he was not quite as outgoing as I am sort of naturally, and he found it much more difficult to reestablish himself time after time after time. And, you know, and of course, growing up with other kids that are all kind of going through the same thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like you would drop into some, you know, incredibly secure infrastructure every time you moved. So a lot of the kids that were in my class and, you know, all around me in these schools were all suffering from the same thing. Nobody knew who they were, and some of them had some severe issues with it. But not me. I basically was the kind of kid that would say to my dad, "Hey, Dad, isn't it time we got out of here and moved somewhere else?"
Who was the biggest influence on your life growing up?
Well, I think both my parents had equal influence. My father had met my mother when she was a naval intelligence officer, right after during the Second World War. That she was a naval intelligence officer, but he met her, you know, shortly after. My dad had been a hero on Iwo Jima, and he was in the Marines, and he had been an intelligence officer and a reconnaissance platoon commander on Iwo Jima. And I think from a career standpoint, that was, you know, the defining kind of attribute of his history, is that he was always known for the entire time he was in the Marine Corps as being a reconnaissance expert, but the Iwo thing was just a big deal. And although he was a very circumspect man in a certain way, he's a very friendly guy, and he said he never lorded the Iwo Jima thing over anybody. He was the kind of guy that every year he would write letters to the wives and parents of the men that in his platoon that were lost on Iwo Jima. And he did that for, 50 years. I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. He was a very religious guy and an accomplished public speaker. And he ended up being, in the Second World War. Then he was an intelligence officer in the Korean War. And he did 3 Vietnam tours. And so, Dad was gone, back and forth a lot of times during my life. And at one point toward the end of his career, he was in Vietnam and I was in Vietnam at the same time, because I went into the Marine Corps myself. And my mother was my father was he was a singer. He was an opera singer before he went into the Marine Corps. So he brought that kind of aspect of culture into our lives. He's a big reader and a guy who liked to sing. My mother, on the other hand, had been, prior to the war, had gone into, had been a dance instructor at the Arthur Murray Studio, which was ballroom dancing back in those days. And so she kind of brought the dance side to things. And she was, my dad was a blonde guy, and my mother had dark hair. My father had come from Chicago, and my mother came from Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And she was a very intelligent and woman. She'd done operational analysis she was the kind of person that could look at a lot of data and discern patterns that were probably not discernible to the average person. Kind of like a beautiful mind. And she did end up, later in life, having significant psychological issues. So, but her brain was the kind that could just click, go into these modes. She ended up being severely bipolar, but she could go into these modes where she could just consume tons and tons and tons of data and then arrive on a perspective that was quite unusual. And I think for me, I'm not the same in that it hasn't destroyed my life, but I have a bit of the habit of doing my creative work. I have a bit of a habit of consuming a lot of data or a lot of input, a lot of material, and then trying to do the same thing, come up with an unusual or unconventional solution to the whatever the creative problem is. So I think I really got that from my mother, and I got my love of music and dance from both of them. So that had a big influence on me. Also, the health issues that they had to deal with throughout their lives, that had an influence on me as well. And so I've had, throughout my career, I've done work in both the music field and the music and dance and music videos specifically. And then I also had a pretty good run in doing healthcare programming. And that really comes out of this sort of philosophy that I have, which is I really look to what's happening in my life to orient me toward what my next career move might be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's sort of like, what lesson is your life trying to teach you now? Well, okay, get on board and do something with it. That's because I don't have a, you know, I didn't go to work for one company and get into one field and then stay in that field forever. I've bounced around and done a variety of different things.
I want to find out what a typical day is like for Mick, but while he thinks about that, let me thank you for your generosity. This has been a fun project, and at every step along the way, people have been helpful and big-hearted. They've given their time, as Mick has, to be interviewed. If you'd like to donate to the cause, click on the donate button at whatsitlike.info. Thanks so much. We appreciate your help.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. I mean,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mick, did you always want to be a music, dance, video, media person?
No, I don't think so. I think the first thing that I can remember thinking that I wanted to be was a medical missionary.
Oh.
I got fascinated when I was around 10 years old with Albert Schweitzer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, what was really cool about him was obviously he was doing this very helpful work in an extremely exotic location. I mean, you know, my TV diet back in those days was probably Jungle Gym and, you know, and a few of the other things. And, you know, my sense of Africa was honed on Johnny Weissmuller movies, you know, that kind of thing. So that was kind of appealing. And the fact that he was the... this highly regarded doctor was kind of, you know, I had really no idea what the study of medicine would be all about, but it seemed like it was a great thing. And then there was the fact, of course, that he was a virtuoso keyboard player.
Yes.
So that all just seemed really, really great because at the time, and, you know, throughout my life, I've really been fascinated with religion. I'm not conventionally religious at this point, but I've always been fascinated with belief systems. And, you know, why people believe what they do and, you know, and where do these notions come from and, you know, what do they mean? Could they be the outgrowth of just a misinterpretation in an ancient text, or could they, you know, are they divinely created or are they humanly created, you know, or a combination of both or whatever. So that always fascinated me. So there was a musical component in there from the very beginning. When I think of, you know, occupationally, so, you know, I toyed also with the idea of becoming an attorney, but relatively early on, I got this, sense that, I really didn't want to be, in a conventionally hierarchical type of, business, you know. I saw my father, you know, I loved a lot of things about the Marine Corps, mostly the sort of the romantic tradition of it, you know, the idea of, you know, the band of brothers and the sense of commitment. It was, you know, almost monk-like in my mind. And I you know, and I grew up, the men that I saw in my life as I was growing up were all, you know, guys that were doing their duty. And, you know, on the female side, women who were pretty much long suffering and very dedicated to family and strong, you know, but frequently destroyed by the life.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, my father was very big on the notion that you could never, you know, once you took a close look around the world, that you're never going to find a place that was better than the United States. And you know, even though the country did make mistakes, throughout its history, that fundamentally it was the greatest thing, you know, on earth, and certainly worth defending anywhere on the globe where freedom was going to be under attack. And this was kind of drummed into me, you know, when I was a child, and it made perfect sense, especially since, you know, everybody in my environment had bought into the same thing as well. You know, I always felt that there was going to be some kind of a service component, at least somewhere in my life. But as, you know, as I got to be a teenager and everything, and I saw how the political element crept into my father's career at that particular time, the higher up he got, you know, the more, ugly it got to me. It wasn't about being sort of the devoted servant. It began to become something about, which team were you, you know, whose team were you on, and what kind of spin did you have to put on things, and, you know, which to me was, now you got to realize that I'm growing up in the 60s. I'm in the high school in the 60s, you know, I'm the class of 1965 at my high school, and the class of 1969 in my collegiate career. So there's a lot of countercultural, there's a lot of input coming up through my life at this particular time that makes me question whether my father's kind of devotion to the establishment has been, is the right way to go. And for me, all the way up through high school, I was, I was the, sort of like the all-American kid.
Mm-hmm.
I did well in school. I was in athletics. I was on the, you know, as the captain of the debating team. I did a lot of extracurricular things. And, you know, before football would happen in the summer, I might be involved in anything from, as you know, something as mundane as vacation Bible school to 1 year I got a grant to study astrophysics at the Agnes Scott Observatory in Atlanta while I was in high school. Yeah, so I was, you know, I was living a kind of a lot of ways a dream life, you know, despite the fact that I wasn't, you know, in my high schools and which were, you know, massive. There were over 750 graduating kids in, you know, in my class. So these were massive kind of prototypical Life magazine top 10 American high school type of places, and there were a lot of military kids in these schools, and they were all not all of them, but many of them were socialized the same way I was, and they were tough, you know, they were ready to compete. So these schools were a crucible in a certain way to get me ready to move on. And I wanted to go back though and say that my mother, with regard to the second influence, I think this was all an outgrowth of a question about who was a big influence in your life. But my mother was the one that always kind of gave me this notion that if you've got a project, try and find something about it that nobody else is going to be thinking about or talking about. See if you can find an angle that is uninvestigated or somewhat unusual that resonates with you, and then mm-hmm. you know, go in that direction so that when you get up there, you know that you're not sort of competing with the same bag of clubs. You know, you've got some really interesting things to say that people are going to go, oh, you know, wow, I didn't know that, or isn't that intriguing, or whatever. So that you've got that kind of chemistry working for you when you're competing. And frequently that'll mean, just sort of turning the whole thing on its ear. And she would always recommend that would be the way to go, you know, do something different. And that was her way of doing things. And her creative solutions to things when we were growing up were frequently very unusual, not embarrassing. You know, in fact, they were always like, they were great. They were just like people would be taken out of themselves, just like art does. My mother was an artist in that sense, and she had the courage to be creative, which a lot of people don't have. They don't want to, they really don't want to buck the system, and the function of art really, in or one of its functions anyway, is to make it clear that you can see things in different ways. There are millions of different perspectives, infinite perspectives on issues and that can be approached, and by doing so, you know, you round out or you add dimensions to the things that were always there, but that nobody really took the time to see.
Mm-hmm. There's several music influences in the 60s. Was there a particular one that you followed?
I was into music from a very early age because it was always just part of the family. My dad had a massive LP collection. And so there was always music on in the household. I know I can remember when I got my first record. In those days, you used to be able to go into the record store and they had these listening booths. Mm-hmm. And you could play the record before you actually bought it. And my dad, we were constantly in record stores because of his, collecting of music. And this was mostly a lot of Broadway show tunes. As I said, my father had been a singer with the Chicago Light Opera Company prior to the outbreak of World War II. And so there was a whole tradition of light operas like Gilbert and Sullivan and Broadway shows and Nelson Eddy type songs. My dad was a baritone, and he would sing these, you know, "Rosemary, I'm calling," you know, that kind of thing. And when we lived in Hawaii, he and a bunch of his friends formed a multi-part harmony ukulele group. So, you know, when I was 3 or 4 years old, I would, you know, I'd be in the house and I'd be hearing these guys doing these barbershop type of harmonies and playing ukuleles, and I learned to play the ukulele myself, and it was just something that was part of the house, you know. There was all this music around. So the 60s were not really that much of a musical explosion for me because there'd just been music nonstop, right, all the way up.
But in your time, there would have been like rock and roll. Elvis was still doing his thing. The Beatles were just appearing. Folk music was really popular. All in the same period of time.
Absolutely. And I was really fortunate when all this was going down that my dad was not, had no prejudices against, like, rock and roll, for example. The first 45 that I ever bought was a rock and roll song. It was called Endless Sleep. And then, you know, at the same time, my dad allowed me to buy one 45 and one LP, and the LP I bought was the Peer Gynt Suite, which was a classical piece. So there were all these different kinds of things, and no genre of music was venerated over any other. Yeah, I had I had all the Beatles records growing up, and I had I was a big Elvis fan when he came out, and the Everly Brothers. And I used to, when I was a kid, my dad gave me a radio, my own radio, when I was 6 years old. And so it was a clock radio, an Emerson, a plastic thing. And it was a beautiful little sort of mid-century modern thing, you know. And I had it in my room, and I would, on Friday nights, they used to introduce the new charts for the next week on the top 40 radio stations. And I used to sit there and, you know, listen all night. You know, it'd be like 4 hours of the top 100 or maybe more, and I would write them all down in order. That was just my thing, you know, so that I would know what the songs were and, you know, so where they were on the charts. And I was never really into who was doing them that much. For some reason, I'm just not a starstruck type of person. This has kind of helped me, in my career, in that I've been able to work with a lot of celebrities and not have to overcome any kind of goo-ga type of response to them. But I was always really interested in the songs themselves and the music, not necessarily the musicians, okay? And that, I would say that's probably still true today, although I really appreciate what different musicians can do and that sort of thing. I think it's the music that really, really moved me. So during the 60s, yes, my mind was pretty much blown by all the music that was happening in those days. And when I ended up being in the music business later, I used to wonder, well, gee, you know, it seems like all this music is not really as good as it was when I was a teenager. So I guess I was really, really fortunate. But I've come to realize that I think all teenagers feel like the music in their era is great because it's for them. Although I have had many kids have said to me in my life, gee, you know, I wish I had grown up, you know, in the 60s because that's when all that music is just, you know, so phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. When I go to a bar or someplace that has has background music that's playing nothing but 60s songs, it just seems like there was such a just, not only were the songs great, but there were just one after another after another after another killer tunes coming out every week, you know. I was one of those kids that had the recording devices early on. You know, I had a reel-to-reel tape deck, which was kind of sort of unusual, and I would get these versions of the albums that were on reel-to-reel tape. Not because I was necessarily so much into the audiophile thing, but my dad had a really good sound system when we were growing up, and you wanted to hear these things as beautiful as they could be. So I had, you know, I had Beatles tapes and I had Brazil 66 and James Taylor and all these, you know, a vast spectrum of music.
On the 7-inch reels.
Yeah, on 7-inch reels. And then eventually, you know, when I got to college, we would make these, my roommates and I bought another Tandberg tape deck. And we would make party tapes, you know, where, you know, we do our own mixes, like mixtapes today. And one of those reel-to-reels could go for like 3 hours. So you just put the thing on and it would be going throughout the entire party. And it was always fun to, you know, it was fun to listen to it, but it was really fun to make it and, you know, come up with the different tune stacks and that kind of thing. So I always knew at some point that I wanted to be, from a career standpoint, involved with music. And
yeah. So bringing it forward to today, what exactly do you do?
Yeah, well, right now, it really depends on what I want to be working on at any particular time, because I do have a skill set with a few different prongs to it. But mostly what I do is in two modes. I'm either writing or producing. And those two things can be applied to just a broad variety of different kinds of things to do there. About 6 years ago, I'd been working with a company called Spotlight Health, which was essentially a celebrity-driven healthcare marketing company. We would use celebrities to tell their health stories in the media and essentially help pharmaceutical companies raise awareness of their products and build their marketing effort. We worked with virtually every big pharmaceutical company going, and our huge hit out of the gate had been a gastric bypass that we broadcast over the internet of singer Carney Wilson, who had been in Wilson Phillips. And she weighed, you know, about 305 pounds, and through our company, we arranged for her to have a gastric bypass, and we followed her through the whole, you know, ramp up to the actual operation, and then we did a live broadcast of the operation over the internet, which caused a sensation. And she became essentially the world's most famous gastric bypass patient, and you know, lost about 150 pounds and everything. And she's been up and down since then. But at the time, it was like for the pharmaceutical business, it was the most incredible celebrity campaign they'd seen in a long, long time. And so we became the sort of the flavor of the month for a bunch of years there. And we worked with a lot of different celebrities on a lot of different healthcare issues. But eventually that company, which was essentially an internet startup, collapsed under its own weight and, victimized itself by growing too fast, not really understanding its business model in depth in terms of, what do you do when you don't get the contract, that sort of thing. So after about 6 years, it was over, 6 or 7 years. And at that particular time, I said to myself, I don't think I'm ready to go back and sort of fight the daily corporate fight. I think maybe, and I'm aging out of the marketplace in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Even when dealing with the executives in the pharmaceutical business, I found myself to be the oldest guy in the room on many occasions, and I could begin to see the kind of the results of ageism, creeping in as something that I was going to have to deal with. It's kind of like, how can you represent yourself as being on top of the pulse of the market if you're an old guy? Of course, the big problem there was I didn't feel old at all. And, for a lot of my previous career, when I was, I was a music video executive for Capitol Records for 13 years. And,
right.
I was always making marketing tools that were for demographics that were younger than I was to begin with. So it was kind of I was sort of a youth market specialist, I felt. And I've always been, interested on what's on TV right now and what's on, what's playing on the radio and what's in the movie theaters. I was an American studies major in college, and my focus has always been sort of pop culture oriented in a certain way. So basically it occurred to me once this was over that I think what I needed to do was go back to what my original dream was when I came to Hollywood, which was, once I got out of the Marine Corps myself, I just got in my car and I drove here, and I wanted to be involved in the writing of movies, specifically movie musicals, but which there were none of at that particular time. And, so I came out here to study, filmmaking and film writing, and I got in the graduate writing program at USC, and then my life sort of spiraled into various directions that led me toward the music business. Out of that, but I got sidetracked pretty early on, and I never really focused on the screenwriting thing the way that I knew I would have to, be competitive at that. So I spoke to my wife, and I said, we'd done, Spotlight Health had been pretty good for us and, financially. And so I said, I really came out here to be a screenwriter and I never really gave it a shot. I think, one of the things that has always that I've always felt has been kind of tragic is that people retire, after, 65 years or whatever. And in many cases, they're like too old and burned out to enjoy their life. They've sort of sacrificed themselves to their occupation for such a long, long time that their identity is sort of compromised to the point they really don't even know who they are when they retire. And so I said, I'm not going to really retire, but I'm going to sort of retire. And meaning I want to work on the screenwriting. I really want to do that. And what that means actually is even going back further and learning how to really tell stories. Now, I'd done a lot of master's degree work in this area. I'd used a lot of storytelling somewhat in the music video work, but more in the marketing. A marketing campaign needs a narrative. The people really need to figure out, what the story is of the product, or in our case, say the musicians. Each musician is a brand, and it needs to be developed as such.
Right.
Over the course of their career. So, the storytelling that the Joseph Campbell, hero's journey type of stuff, that was all kind of integrated into the marketing work that underlies any music video. A music video is essentially the an evocation of a marketing concept. Because every music video is really a portrait of an artist. It's not so much the portrait of the song. Primarily, it should not be the portrait of the song as much as it is a portrait of the artist that is revealed through the experience of the music and the visuals.
So you're not trying to put the song to slides.
Well, you know, sometimes that may be the best thing to do is to, you know, focus on the song. But if the song doesn't in some way resonate with the artist persona, then essentially you're not really building the song's career. You're building the artist's career.
Right. So you have to, has to serve the bigger process as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of like in storytelling, you know, they talk about mini arcs and overarching arcs and everything. So a lot of different considerations that come into play when determining what should be the appropriate video for an artist, and that song at that particular time. At least from my perspective, it's much more sophisticated than the vast majority of people have any idea, all the different sort of fashion considerations and whatever. But storytelling thing, it was something that I was aware of, but a music video is, you can do a narrative, A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D, whatever, and follow your arcs and that kind of thing for a music video. That's more like a country music video, where the narrative seems to be something that is more popular. But as you get to sort of rock and roll music video or hip-hop music video, these really aren't telling stories as much as they're sort of more poetic. They're more impressionistic in the way that they go down. So in that sense, you don't learn a terrific amount about storytelling from music videos. You learn more about metaphors and free associations and how these metaphors resonate with aspects of the image of the artist's image. So image building in the music business, you build a narrative, but you build it with impressionistic components in a lot of cases.
What's the best thing about your job?
The best thing about my job right now, it's a blessing and a curse. It's that you can do anything that you want. I try every day to create, I work on a couple of different screenplay projects that have been ongoing for me for quite a while. And I also then I do a good amount of reading. I never liked to read that much when I was a kid or even when I was in college, but then I eventually found the joy of it. And I compared to most people, I read a lot of material all the time. And so what I like about my work is that there's a lot of brainstorming, there's a lot of dreaming involved, but at the same time, you have to get beyond the dreaming and get to the point of actually the making of things, the realization of them. And that's the hard part, because with a motion picture, in many cases, you have to get somebody else to pay for it. Because it's an expensive undertaking.
What's the worst thing about your job?
I think the uncertainty.
Mm.
Never knowing whether or not anybody's going to appreciate your ideas.
Mm-hmm. What type of person do you think would be good at your job?
Well, someone who's imaginative. The first thing that you have to be able to do is you have to sort of develop techniques for sort of understanding what the desired outcome of your project is supposed to be, and then imaginatively reverse engineer it to the point where it will fulfill the all the requirements that it has to get to where it needs to go. I normally have a concept for something, like a high concept, which worked really great in the music video business, but doesn't really necessarily work it doesn't work completely in the film writing business. In that you go to a party and someone says, "What are you doing?" "Well, I'm writing." And they go, "Well, what are you writing with screenplays?" "Oh, well, I've got a great idea for a screenplay." And you can have it, just give me a piece of the back end. You'll hear this all the time. Well, the reality of it is that a great idea for a screenplay is it's not a story. a story is something that really has, you know, it has a beginning, a middle, an end. It has arcs in every scene. It's really quite a complicated thing to do it well. And that's why only about 300 movies get made every year, because and many of them are bad. Because it's because their stories are not really well worked out, and they don't ring true for one reason or another. And one of the quotes that I've heard about storytelling that really resonates with me is that what's the difference between fiction and reality? Well, fiction has to make sense.
I like that.
You know, yeah, reality doesn't, you know, often doesn't make sense, and it's that's why we find it both fascinating and confounding.
Is there a typical day for you, or do you have a time for writing and a time for something?
No, I don't. And you know, compared to most people that are successful in this business, I would say that my approach is really quite chaotic. I still occasionally do take marketing tool jobs from time to time, just from people, I guess, who know me and say, hey, you might be good for this. And I did a Barry Manilow job recently, and I'm not a huge fan, but I was I'm a fan of making musical marketing tools, so that's what I did. But no, I don't have a certain time for writing. I try to one of the things that I've done in my career in general is I don't like to get up that early in the morning. And I was in the Marine Corps for 7 years, and I was a platoon commander in Vietnam. And then I had a lot of work in the Washington D.C. area, and I got up every day of my life for 7 years before I wanted to. And so once I got out of the Marine Corps, I decided to leave the Marine Corps, and I came here to California. One of my goals was to work in an area that sort of was in sync with my natural biology. And that's why I got into the music business, which is basically a late night, not an early morning thing, although filmmaking is an early morning thing. So in many cases, though, because I was the executive producer or, you know, the production executive on these things and not the actual filmmaker, I could show up when I wanted to. Obviously, if you think that something's not going to go well, then you need to be there. I certainly did get up early a lot of times. But in general, I don't get up that early, but I like to be working by about 11 o'clock. And I happen to just be the type of person that can either, if nothing's happening, then, you know, I'm, when I say, and what do I mean that by that? I mean, if I'm not working on a specific project where I can, I have a sort of menu of issues to address, then could be just sitting there trying to figure out, the way that I work essentially on my stories is that, what would he do, what would he do next, or how would he respond to this particular development? What makes sense realistically? What would be the conventional solution? Now, what kind of unconventional things can we build in here? And so it becomes really an investigation, trying to essentially pull out of your mind something that seems, unusual, but once it's actually integrated, it becomes it has a sort of an inevitability to it that is very satisfying. So, in other words, I wouldn't have expected that, but, given the way things have been going, that's exactly what should have happened, that kind of thing. Because surprising people is a big part of entertaining them.
Mm-hmm. Mick will tell you exactly what you should do with your life right after I remind you of the good work being done by St. Jude's. I highly recommend that you go to stjude.org. This is the site for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. It is a great place to browse. You'll find a picture of their patient of the month. They do good work, and they could really use your help. My little brother was very sick, had massive brain damage and a blood disorder like leukemia. There was no St. Jude's at that time, but there is now. You can help. Go to St. Jude's and click on the donate button. It costs over $1 million a day to operate St. Jude's. So chip in. Go to stjude.org and give. I also added St. Jude's to my Facebook page. After all, how could you not like St. Jude's? So, Mick, everyone has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, I think your bank account has a pretty good function in that regard. You know, I guess compared to most people, I hang it out a little bit more than most. In other words, you know, many people might say, gee, I've got to get something going here. I've got nothing happening. I might, you know, wait a few more weeks or months than or years maybe than they would. But because I guess the story of a lot of my work is that it sort of parallels the hero's journey in that it seems like if you can still be in there when all is lost, if you can still be, you know, committed to the project when it looks like it's going to completely fall apart and then disaster is going to strike, if you can sort of still be there, you can snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. And a lot of my, I would think a lot of my success has been as a result of just hanging in, you know. That also means that I've had some incredible disappointments, where I've hung in the hope that it's all going to pull together, and it just didn't. Again, it's that sort of double-edged sword. But I think I really don't have a difficult time in motivating myself to do work because if I can't get any enthusiasm up for one thing, well then there's 20 other things on the list that could be addressed and sort of move forward. Now, I think Orson Welles said that something along the lines of the greatest enemy of creativity is unlimited options, in a sense, if you have unlimited options, then you don't really make a decision. And for me, I have a variety of, you know, several different kinds of projects that I'm interested in. So if one starts to get wobbly, I just set it aside and go off to the next one. And eventually, you know, something gets to the point where it's ready to sell. You know, it's like it's reached its sell date, and that's when I go into my other mode, you know, which is the part that I never ever really even thought about when I was when I thought about this business, was that I'd have to sell my work. I you dream about just doing it, but being able to sell it is a wholly different enterprise. So then once I've got something, you know, I make a PowerPoint presentation of it, or I'll make a fake 1 minute video trailer out of bits and pieces of other movies to sort of give to have something when I go into the meeting that is not the standard type of pitch. And because I've made short, hundreds and been executive producer and the creative director on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of classic music videos, I can make a 1 minute film, 1 minute trailer with relative ease. You know, it has its difficulties, but and which I'm, you know, well aware of, but I can put that together, and that makes the sales process a kind of a really interesting thing for me, because basically I go in and I show a little movie. I might have a mock-up of a poster or something like that, and I entertain as I sell, which has been my angle on virtually anything. If I were teaching a class in psychology, I would want to do everything I could to make it entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And because I know that works. I know that you can embed all the information in there and make it entertaining and even better interactively entertaining, then it's going to be much more memorable for everybody involved.
When you have to calm yourself down, how do you soothe yourself?
Oh, I do pranayama. It's a yogic breathing techniques. I learned these, many years ago now from a guy named Dr. Andrew Weil, who's an integrative medicine specialist, and he wrote a couple of books, and I worked on a couple of these projects for PBS, 8 Days to Optimal Health, and that sort of thing. Anyway, pranayama is a way of controlling the breath. It can be used as a meditative technology. And so if I really need to calm myself down, I just do my breathing regimen. Mm. And there are a variety, when you study pranayama, there are a variety of different breath patterns that evoke different sorts of physiological responses, and some of them are really good for calming you down, rebooting yourself, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
I would have to say that there have been a variety of events that have challenged me to the core. I mean, being an infantry platoon commander in Vietnam was quite challenging. You know, one specific event during that period of time, I don't know that I could pull out one that was more challenging than the other, but I was very aware during that period of time that I was stressed. You know, there was a high level of cortisol in my body at all times, and that the situation was really, really uncomfortable. And then, dealing with the illnesses that eventually killed my parents, I think that I found those... both of those situations. My dad, had a terminal diagnosis of cancer at one particular point. Then we were able to turn that around. I was very, that was very demanding for me psychologically to not be overcome with the fear of his death. And my mother, as I said, had, mental illness, which was extremely trying for, many, many decades, and essentially ruined my father's and even my notion of, what it was going to be like for them in their golden years, and, what my mother was going to be like as a grandmother to my daughter, and, that it wasn't the picture that you imagine, it was supposed to be. And then I really do have to say that this screenwriting thing has been so much more difficult than I imagined it would be, especially just in terms of being able to make progress for me and to focus enough on specific things so that I could move in a productive direction. And I've been a lot less productive, perhaps, than I imagined I was going to be, because I didn't really have any idea of what was involved and how difficult it was to do this, to master this. And I'm dedicated to it. I've been really profoundly disappointed in the fact that I didn't become a famous screenwriter overnight. And that it's taken, that it's taken so long. And in that regard, I have to give my wife, some major props, because she's, had to partner in a lot of this frustration. And I'm not the kind of guy that acts out or anything like that. But, it's like day after day after day after day, it's not like people are calling every day and saying, hey, let me buy this, let me buy that, let me buy that. So these are the spikes of success with a music video. You had, they take 8 weeks to make, and you're pumping them out, and there are all these sort of spikes of success, or a campaign, a pharmaceutical campaign. You're off and running. But with these things where you're sitting in a room every day and you're just trying to put words on a screen and make them all work out and get everything ready, it stretches out over a long period of time, and the chemistry of success that you become addicted to is more elusive than ever.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through these challenges?
Probably only that I would be suffering much more if I had sold out.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if I'd become and this is not taking anything away from, someone who sells insurance or, is in retail or something like that. I just worked in a bank, as an investment banker or whatever. I just know that those are things that, what would I be doing? I'd be sitting there trying to be productive while I'm dreaming of, what I'm doing, what I'm doing now. So on the one hand, if I die before I get any of these things, into the marketplace of ideas or whatever, well, that'll be, I'll be disappointed, or I'll be even more disappointed if I give up on myself, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The way that I always approach it is that if it's not going to be fun for me, I know I'm not going to stick with it anyway. So I've got to figure out, I got to go in the direction of where my interest lies at that particular moment, and where my passion is exposing itself, so that I can stick with it, because otherwise I just won't. It'll wither on the vine, and I'll be wasting my life.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say? What would be your best advice?
Well, I would say that you need to really look, try and get a sense of who you are, and it's very difficult when you're a young person to do that. But you need to really listen to your heart in certain at this time, and say, okay, what do I really want to pour myself into? If you go off to college and you're just sort of figuring, well, can I game the system, or how can I get through it by doing the least amount of work that I possibly can, or if you graduate from college and you sort of look around and you say, well, gee, what am I going to do now? Well, I think that's a sort of a symptom of not really doing the work that you need to at least give some kind of direction to your life, and that direction should be in my mind anyway, in the area of where you really feel like you're enjoying your life, where it's really sort of your life is kind of like singing to you, and the only way that it's going to sing to you is if you sing to it. What makes a great song? That's when you put your whole, the artist puts himself or herself, they put themselves totally into it. So I would say try and get a real sense of what it is that makes you happy, what fascinates you. Where are you fascinated? Gee, I could hear people talk about this subject or that subject for hours. It strikes a chord with me. Figure out what that is and just go for that. And the reality of it's going to be that it's probably not going to be anything like what you dreamed it was like. Once you get in there, I found this to be true in almost every job I've ever had. At one point I thought, gee, it would really be great to be the editor of a magazine. And so I set to work on it, and eventually I did become the editor of a couple of different publications. But it wasn't anything really like I thought it was going to be. It was really a matter of being more concerned about whether or not you sold enough ads, to make a profit in the publishing business, as it was what content were you going to be creating, and who are you going to, get to create it. So I just feel like you can't go terribly wrong if you pour yourself into it, if you can figure out something and then you can really pour yourself into it. The antithesis of that, going to work every day and hating what you're doing, to me, that's just that's a real tragedy. That, that's like Babbitt, the guy lives his whole life, and from the outside, people would think he's a success, but on the inside, he's a really withered, pathetic thing, because he devoted his life to something that he didn't really love. So I would just basically find that thing you absolutely love and pour yourself into it.
I want to thank Mick Clever for joining me today. Thanks, Mick. I really appreciate it.
Okay.